So I'm speaking today to James Scott, who is a senior training and support officer at the UK Data Service and works very closely in a secure lab with a lot of users that require his support. So it's great to talk to you today, James.
Oh, thanks, Rodney. Thanks for asking me.
Fantastic. You do some amazing work there in the secure lab, so it's good to kind of get up to speed what you've been up to recently. So to start with, can you provide us with a summary of how the secure lab works?
I'll try and sort of sum it up in a few points, really, just to get the gist of it, really. I mean, to put it in context, most research data centers like ourselves, certainly when Secure Lab was initially set up a decade ago, they were all physical locations that you'd have to go and visit. So, you know, you could be working away in the university and you think, oh, I need to do some work on my project. Where's the nearest research data center? And you'd have to book in there, and it might be, if you were lucky, it might be 2 miles away, but it might have been 100 miles away or 200 miles away. And then you'd have to go up or down there and, you know, book in, spend a day there, potentially not quite finish what you were doing, and then have to book in another day. And obviously for researchers, particularly if, you know, they've got teaching duties and other things as well to do, I mean, finding that sort of time is quite difficult. So when Secure Lab was initially set up, the idea was that this would be a remote access service so that researchers could access these data, these controlled level, highly detailed data sets, actually from their offices at their institutions. They didn't actually have to go to a physical location. So that's really, you know, that was the sort of initial spark of it, I guess. It's really convenience. I mean, if you use Secure Lab, you can pretty much use it 24/7, except for Tuesday mornings when we have a regular shutdown. So really what we're doing is, we hold controlled level data. So what we mean is data that it hasn't got people's names and addresses or, you know, necessarily all companies, because we have a lot of business data. It hasn't got those primary identifiers in it. They've been removed. But because of the level of data, so low-level geographies, potentially age, gender, ethnicity, or company turnover and things like that, because the detail is so, detailed, really, you know, there's every possibility of being able to identify people or businesses within that. I mean, you'd only have to add, you know, age and a geography and one other thing, and then potentially you can identify an observation. So this is why we have to be so careful about it and keep these data in a safe setting. Okay, so Secure Lab really is a sealed off environment. So when people access it from their institution, they effectively open up like another desktop, really, and you can't copy anything across from that environment to your own computer. You can't access the internet, you can't print from it or anything like that. It's really a sealed off kind of area, and nothing goes in or out of that project area unless it goes through us, through the support team. There are sort of things that you, boxes you have to tick, I guess, to be able to use these kind of data in this kind of way. Firstly, you have to have accredited researcher status. And what that means is that you will have attended Safe Researcher training and you will have subsequently passed the online test. And what that really does is provides researchers with an understanding of the requirements and actually the quite particular principles that need to be applied when you're using a safe setting like this. Because although, you know, we have people come to us that have years potentially of research experience, if they haven't used these kind of data in this kind of environment, there will be things that will be new to them. And we have to make sure that they're totally on board with that and that they understand everything.
That has multiple benefits, really. So one of the benefits, I guess, is a little bit what the UK Data Service is all about, is protecting people's identity. So can you tell us about how essential the Secure Lab is in kind of respecting people's identity, and why is that so important to the service and you know, to our society in terms of respecting when people give valuable information for social science research?
Well, you've kind of hit the nail on the head with your question there, really, Rodney, because they have been good enough to give us their data, or give the data collector their data. And so, you know, we don't want to play fast and loose with it. We want to, you know, need to respect it and respect the fact that they've given that information. So, and as I say, because the data we hold is so detailed, you know, there is still that risk of identification of entities, and attributing other information, you know, to them. So it's really, really important, not just sort of legally, because obviously, you know, there is a legal, you know, duty to, you know, not be able to identify people or businesses from these data, but also a kind of moral duty as well. You know, it's not just because it's, you know, a legal thing. There is also like a moral duty, we think anyway. What we really do is we use what is known as the Five Safes framework, okay, to think about data access. It's quite a widely known thing, really. It's, you know, we're looking initially to see that we have a safe project, and then, you know, that there is a safe person. And when we talk about people being safe, so researchers being safe, it's not a moral judgment, it's a practical judgment. And part of that is ensuring that they know where they can go when they need help. You know, we have to get this right. It's, you know, it's really important stuff, and we have to mitigate any potential risks that there are. We can't watch researchers accessing remotely 24/7, obviously, but, you know, we want it to be as safe as it can possibly be. And we're very lucky that our target audience, you know, they're not trying to do anything malicious. We don't really have any real problems at all in that regard. But nonetheless, we have to be vigilant and respect the fact that people have given their data over for research purposes.
How much are those principles part of the values of UK Data Service? How much is that part of the DNA and the identity of the organisation?
Oh, I think it's a very strong part, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, we all come from research backgrounds. Everyone on the training and support team has all done research to one level or another. I mean, several of us have doctorates, the others have, you know, degrees or whatever. So we all come from that kind of background. And obviously, when you're doing that kind of stuff, you know, when you're coming through and you're training in that, you know, the ethical side of things is very much stressed. You know, you don't want to cause distress or harm to anyone. You don't want to reveal things about people. So, you know, it's kind of, I think probably it's the case for most people in most teams, or maybe all, that because we come from these kind of backgrounds, that it's just kind of drilled in, and therefore the archive does have that in its DNA, just you know, just a standard, really.
It's just natural for you to be that way, to protect the identity of the people who've been interviewed, just because that's the way you've been trained to work.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, we're all aware as researchers or people that have done research that response rates aren't always fantastic. And the one thing you don't want to do is have people think that we're, you know, that we're not respecting or looking after their data properly. So, you know, you don't want that to sort of become a widely held sort of belief, so that response rates drop even further. So, you know, there are practical reasons, but as I say, also, I think, you know, it's in our DNA.
So we know that the protection and the integrity of the data is at the highest level, which is why the Secure Lab exists, to protect that. So talking from the researcher's point of view now, so when it was created like 10 years ago now, was there anything else just, like it?
Yeah, it's around 10 years now, yeah.
Yeah. Was there anything else like it of its kind in the UK? Was it one of the first?
Not really. We led the way. It was set up, as I say, around a decade ago. I've been with the service now a little over 7 years. So it came into being a little bit before my time. But I've been around for I guess, the bulk of it. And, well, anecdotally, anyway, I've heard that, you know, initially, once the idea was proposed, that, you know, there was a little resistance to it. The idea that you would let people access data this detailed from a remote connection where you couldn't watch them constantly. I think there was a little bit of resistance, is kind of what I've heard. But as it, you know, we've shown really that researchers are trustworthy, and we do trust researchers. And I think, you know, the fact that researchers can access, you know, 24/7, they, you know, if they're an insomniac, they can, you know, they can work at 3 a.m, or if they get up really early, they can start early in the morning, they can work for 10 hours or 10 minutes if they just need to tweak something. You know, that's a real sort of bonus for researchers. And, you know, I think, you know, that's the main thing. And whilst there are now other services that are offering remote access to different degrees, you know, we really were the first to do it on any kind of scale. So yeah, I and that's that's a really nice feeling to know that we kind of led the way in that.
So this is pioneered at the University of Essex and Colchester. So others have been created around the country since then, would you say?
Yeah, there have been a few. There are a number of them, some of which are members of the Safe Data Access Professionals group that myself and Christine Woods from the team, we run that group now. It has been run by others, but UK Data Service have taken it over as of about the last year or so, which acts as a good resource, actually, for people, A, working in this industry, because it's a bit niche, really, and also for researchers as well. We try to, you know, provide useful materials and resources for both parties, really.
It's really kind of valuable for researchers in terms of being able to access high-level data remotely. And could you give us an example of how valuable and how important that data is? What kind of data can they access, which is of a very high standard?
Oh, wow. There is a lot of important work that comes out off the back of the data that we make available by a secure lab. We hold a lot of business data, but we also hold various other types of data in there. And just sort of off the top of my head, I mean, we have facilitated work on, I was looking at alcohol pricing and its effect on crime and health, on comprehensive schools and social mobility, trade union membership, the Great Recession, gendered pay differences, potential consequences of post-Brexit trade deals. It's wide. It's really, really varied. Because not only can people, you know, use a particular data set, there are many of our data sets that we hold in Secure Lab that it's possible to link them together in varying combinations to look at varying things and apply different analysis. So everything we see that comes out of Secure Lab, it's all potentially quite different. But a lot of these things will then go on to inform public policy and therefore sort of have a genuine effect on the world, hopefully, you know. Yeah, yes. There's a lot of possibilities and a lot of things that can be done with these data.
Yes, it's an incredible array of data sets there that you've just discussed. Can you give examples of when researchers have used any of these data sets in their work that has had a sort of an impact on helping to improve people's lives through their studies?
Well, really, I mean, the things that the list that I kind of went through a moment ago, really, I mean, that those are actual, you know, those are projects rather than the data sets. So in all of those areas, you know, I mean, if you think about, alcohol pricing and its effect on crime and health, I mean, you know, there's been work done on that from data sets in the Secure Lab. And, you know, that's been kind of, you know, it's been talked about quite a lot over the last few years in terms of, you know, how that, whether that will work to, you know, decrease crime and health issues, you know, and obviously, you know, it has actually come into being. So, yeah, I mean, that's obviously had an effect. There's been, I think, pretty much since the inception of Secure Lab, there's been stuff on, you know, the glass ceiling and gendered pay differences, those kind of projects coming out of the data sets that we hold. And of course, that's really important as well, because we know, particularly with high profile cases like the BBC, that, you know, there still are really gendered pay differences. Just because of your gender, you're getting paid something entirely different from someone else doing the same job. So whilst we like to think we're very advanced, some of these problems still persist. And that's why people are still looking into this stuff.
Wow, so researchers who've accessed a Secure Lab have basically got access to data sets and data information that's helped them to report back on how, for example, the price of alcohol has had an impact on people's health.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible, isn't it, really, that the opportunity that Secure Lab provides for researchers to kind of put together projects that could influence government policy and help to improve people's health.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of what it's all about, really. I mean, that's why, you know, that's really why this service is in place. You know, we need this research. This research can actually have really positive effects for, you know, for communities and for individuals, you know, potentially, if it is taken up by governments and used to inform policy, which, you know, we all know that perhaps it isn't always. But, you know, it increases knowledge and understanding in certain areas. And yeah, I guess sometimes the ideas take a few years to filter through, but, you know, ultimately this can have really positive effects on the world. And, you know, that's a nice feeling for us on the team that, you know, we're helping researchers to increase this knowledge and be able to then sort of, you know, make that available to people who may be able to use it to inform policy. That's a good feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And you actually support them through the process of access to the data and what their goals are within using the data, your team helps them to get the information that they need. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, what we do is, I mean, one of the core things about the Secure Lab, as I said earlier, that nothing goes in or out of Secure Lab without it coming through the support team. And when we're actually looking at the analysis, so the work that the analytical outputs, we tend to call them, that researchers are actually doing in Secure Lab, when they say, oh, you know, I've finished writing my paper or my book chapter or my report or whatever it might be, there are many, many different types of things that people produce in Secure Lab. But before we actually release it from Secure Lab, it has to go through the process of statistical disclosure control, which essentially means that we employ a two-person manual check through that entire output, that piece of work, to ensure that there's any residual risk of identification or attribution of information to individuals or businesses, you know, that we've mitigated against that potential risk as best as we possibly can. And one of the things that we do around that, I mean, this isn't the only thing we teach on the Safe Researcher Training course, which actually, you know, all researchers have to do to become accredited researchers and be able to access these data. One of the things that we do on that course is we have quite a lot of examples about the kind of things that we would generally see in the outputs that people want released, so that we can then explain to people, you know, why this might be acceptable, why this might not be, but what they can do about it to make it acceptable. One of the things that I'm very fond of saying on the training is that there's always an alternative way to tell your story. And maybe instead of using this plot of residuals that's, you know, that's actually quite disclosive, maybe you can do something else instead, or, you know, transform the data, do something else. Maybe you can suppress these values, but, you know, you still be able to tell your story. So we're always about providing advice and just really supporting users through the life of their project.